Agenda item number 16, oyster replenishment plan. Dr. Weston.
What we have to do on the plan is we always go through this plan every time. At this year, it's already been through the Shellfish Management Committee and been approved. But the main thing we need for the commission is the approval of the procurement methods that we use for implementing the plan. So just keep that in mind at the very end so that I don't forget. And also, at the end, I mean, after we've done this, we had an interesting discussion at SMAC last week as we started effort control, and I want to tell you a little bit about that and hopefully get some further guidance from the commission on how they'd like that committee to proceed. So, don't need to show that anymore. Obviously, up through this 14-15 season, we're doing very well on oyster harvest. When we're talking about the replenishment plan, we're talking about the red here. I mean the yellow, what we do on the public. It's where we take the money that we get from the General Assembly or other places and we do oyster restoration. We have been getting $2 million now for 3 years, which is the most consistent funding that we've ever received. So that's very good, but we don't get nearly as far on the amount of money as we did before we got the $2 million. So we have that issue. We do both a little bit of seed and a little bit of shell. We're going to move some seed from the James River, which is the place that we have seed readily available, to the Potomac tributaries, do about 10,000 bushels of that. We normally do a little bit of that every year. That's gotten more expensive also, but the reason we moved to those areas is because we don't get a natural spatula up there. So we take the relatively high counts we get in the James River, about 1,000 oysters per bushel, and move them up to an area that doesn't get a spat set. We're also, we had a very good spat set generally on the west side of the bay this year. And next year, I mean, this coming fall, this area 4 in the Rappahannock, will open up for a harvest and a rotation. And we had one little bar that was right down near the bridge, which is here, it's called Ferry Bar, that got an exceptional spat set for some reason. And since it's going to be opened up, I mean, we're basically looking at, you know, bushel counts there that are 1,000 or more shares per bushel, that obviously there's no way they will make it to market size by this season. So, when they're that thick, they're going to grow slower. So we're actually going to move about 2,000 bushels from that bar up into this area 7, which is up the Rappahannock River, again in an area where we didn't get a spat set because it gets too fresh up there. We don't get as good a sets up there, which is kind of taking advantage of an opportunity that we haven't seen before. We also have a program that we've been running routinely where we have two seed rivers in Mid-Bay, the Great Wicomico River, the Yankton River, that we take care of, we put shells on, and we allow industry to go catch a quota of seed there and put them on their private ground, and they give back to us in order to take a bushel. They give us 2 bushels of shell back on the same area. And this just shows the Piag tank, and just take on from here is that there's about 100 oysters, a little more than 100 oysters per meter on the areas that we're doing this routinely, which is the same as the bars that we have that we're not doing anything, that we're leaving as sanctuary. So it does not look like anything we're doing is hurting these areas. So we'll be advertising for 20,000 bushels. We may take a little bit more than that this year, somewhere between 20,000 and 25,000 bushels of seed, and let the industry have them and replace them with shell. The Great Wicomico did not have as good a set this year. It was okay set, but it wasn't good enough to actually move seed, so we won't have the program in that river this year, which is different than the past couple of years. The rest of our time gets spent on doing shells. We Every fall, we do a stock survey of live oysters as well as the shell. And we have, over the years, found out that the shells disappear over time. And just the harvesting process is hard on them. They dissolve. Boring sponge gets in them, and they get covered over. And what we see in most of the areas that we actively work, the miscellany areas with the spats that are relatively repeatable, the half-life of the shells is 3 or 4 years, so we have to continuously be adding shells back. And when we have an arbitrary number in our stock acceptance of about 5 liters per meter, so if you put a meter in front of you, 5 liters is about half of like a little wash bucket worth of shells. And if we stay above that, we actually see spat sets most of the time. If we drop below that, we stop seeing them. So we have about 1,300 acres that need shell. With the $2 million that we have, we'll probably be able to afford to do 500 or so. So we're running negative on shell, but we picked three rivers to concentrate on, just because in our most of the shells that we're doing now are the dredged fossil shells, and if the less complicated we can make it for the contractor, the better price he gives us for them. So we're going to work in New York, where this shows areas that need it, these pink areas. The Rappahannock has got quite a few areas that need new shell. A lot of the areas that we harvested this past year will get new shell. Then we have, for Pocomoke, Pocomoke's the only place that we didn't see any spats at this year for some reason, but we have some areas up there that need shell. And in Tangier, so in Pocomoke, Tangier, we get kind of get the same price for going up there that we do for they're side by side, so they're the same price. Also doing one little additional project we have these two bars in Pocomoke Sound that we've done the past 2 years that we've actually put dredge shell on them, and we've missed spat sets on those areas both years. And we're going to allow one or two of the shell boats that are left to go out there and if you don't catch spat set on these areas, and the areas are in these wide open places like this, some of the shells start to cover over, and we're going to try to get back up about 20,000 bushels. It's relatively inexpensive for us to do that, and the shells are so valuable, and so it gives the few shell boats that we have a little bit of work to do to try to go around the edges and pick up the ones that are maybe an inch under the surface and put them on the best parts of these bars, and hope that after on the third year will be the charm, we'll actually get a spat set there. For our shells, we depend greatly on fossil shells that for the past, since about 2000, past 16 years, we've had a permit to dredge fossil shells on these areas that are way up. This is Hog Island, where the power plant is, and King's Mill is over here. And these little yellow spots are where fossil shells are located, and we've had a permit there. And for VMRC, we've taken about 11 million bushels out of there in the past 15 years. Our partners have taken more bushels out of that. Don't have an exact count on that, but they've been very productive for us. And our two biggest areas, this one here that was about 23 acres and this one was about 10 acres, they're gone. And the only thing we're left with are two smaller areas. And so we've been really concerned about that. And, you know, I went through some old papers that we had on potential places where fossil shells existed, and I knew I'd looked at these things in the 90s, but kind of got the, since we found this area up there that was kind of out of everybody's way, we kind of gravitated up to that area just to work with a permit there. But in the early 60s, the commission, I think, hired a contractor to look for the buried shells that were left down in the lower James River primarily. And this area, which is just off, we're sitting right over here right now. This is the shipyard we're out of here, just off from us, about 2 miles up from the Monitor Merrimack, right across on public grounds, straight across from the shipyard, is where they found this blue, this was a fossil shell deposit that they were fairly certain that was pretty rich, had a lot of shells. It's about 3 feet underground. We rechecked this in the late 90s with the contractor that we work with. And, yeah, there we knew that there are shells there. But in the late 90s, we had a very active clam fishery here. And so we really didn't want to think about doing a permit here. But that clam fishery is pretty much gone by the wayside and seems to be a very, you know, if very good opportunity for us. We've turned in permits there. We don't have to permit ourselves with a permit to do this shell dredging. So it's being looked at by the Corps of Engineers and NOAA and our other people that do the JPA. It's about 650 acres of shell here that, since we were normally doing up in that other, about 3 to 5 acres a year to give us the amount we got, this will last us a long time if it's as rich as where we've been working. And a little bit that some of you have seen this dredge, but it's a very unique contraption. It's the only one in the world like it. This same machine has been working since, it's certainly been working in the bay for Maryland and Virginia since the 70s, but it may have been even working before that. And it's just a mining operation that in the front here, it's got it like a Indicott dredge, spinning dredge, and it spins the stuff up, and it goes through conveyors, goes into the superstructure here where it's washed and shooken, it shakes and washes and sorts, and it sorts between the whole shells over here and fine shells over here that, and then we take these shells on this side and we go plant them. So from the, you know, the 11 million bushels that we've harvested up the way, I mean, we've done just thousands of acres of restoration with those shells. And, you know, 5 acres that we use in a year ends up doing 500 acres of shell restoration. It has special baffles and pipes that put the spoil back, and it goes right underneath the dredge, so that the spoil goes right back into the hole that it's cutting. And even though it can dig to 50 feet, that would mean most of these areas we're going to are between 7 and 15 feet deep. So it can actually only go down about 35 feet. And we put back half of that amount. So we end up cutting a hole of about 10 to 20 feet deep every year. It depends on. The veins are different. Sometimes they go all the way to the bottom. When we get all the way, the thing is straight down, and he's still getting shell, and he has to quit. Lots of times he'll only go down 10 or 15 feet, and that's where we'll stop. So it varies with what they find. But this thing has been adapted over the time. He gets paid for the shells that he actually sells us, so it's very efficient. We've had a VIM study in 2000 when we started this, where we looked at the plume that came from it. It's a very short-lived plume. So, you know, just 4 or 5 kilometers, you can't tell that anything was there. Most of the sediment is just a straight line from the dredge while he's working. So we're very hopeful that this will go through, and in my conversations with the Corps and NOAA, it seems to be moving through fine. We'll be under the same restriction, time of year restriction that you were talking about this morning, June 15th. We can't start. We would love to be able to start 15 days earlier, because we'd get a head start on SPAT, but you know, we've had to abide by that same time period. So the last little bit of things we do, we got about $100,000 for shell planting on Eastern Shore, and we're also continuing to work with our partners in various places on alternative substrates. We had a big project in the Piankatank that we have done in advance of the Corps working in the Piankatank. We've done a project with the Nature Conservancy. We've finished our match for that. We've done that project. It's actually, used ground concrete and granite last year. The ground concrete and granite both have had the highest bath sets that we've seen for anything that we put overboard, but obviously it's not good for the industry, and we try to save our shell for the industry. But it's alternate substrate works great for sanctuaries, and that's where we've limited it to. We did, just for your own for your information, because it was a part of the program last year, we tried a different size of ground granite for a harvest area. We had tried it the year before, and we didn't really like our results because we tried shell size pieces, and when we went back and we got a great set on it, but we went back and checked it this year in the fall survey, we could see that we're banging hard concrete against shell that's softer, and we're killing a lot of the oysters. So we went with a smaller gravel size this past year, and it turned out to be one of the highest bath sets that we saw anywhere, like 700 oysters per meter on this concrete and granite, and it's only about that big, so that now when it comes up in a dredge, it'll just be an oyster with a little piece of that concrete. So we're very hopeful that, you know, down the road, if we can kind of pave the way with that, that private ground may be able to use something like that, that small gravel for their ground to catch spat on. So we'll see how that goes, and that'll actually be opened up into the fishery year after next, and that hopefully they'll be big enough to give us some information on that. But so we're working in the Piang Tank with alternative substrate with our partners, also doing a little bit more work with the Nature Conservancy there and with CBF. We're working in Lafayette on some alternative substrate projects as partners with CBF and NOAA. And we're hopefully going to have a reef in New York with HRSD that we'll do for them as a mitigation using alternative substrate that we'll get in the water this spring in time to catch spat set. So that's a real quick run through on what we're doing, mostly doing shell as we always do with the amount of funds that we have. So,
Jim, you want to take up the emergency measure at this point?
No, I'll get this first, and then I'll go on into the effort control.
Okay. Are any questions from the commission? Thank you, Dr. Weston. This is a public hearing. Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to be heard on this matter? Seeing none. Mr. Cedar.
He ask us to remind him of at the end of the speech?
That when you approve this, you're also approving about the procurement that we do, the procurement practices.
Okay, is that coming next?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Erskine.
So I just wanted to maybe give an indication of what took place at SMAC it was last week. We had a full committee and discussed the replenishment plan as written, and it was unanimous that the committee recommended to the board that it get approved as written. There's there was quite a bit of discussion about, you know, the money and shells being fossil shells and house shells coming from oyster shucking plants. And I think, although it was not generally discussed, I wonder, Jim, if there's an opportunity to look at house shell and fossil shell, like on an area wherever it may be that would get strike and similar substrate prior to planting those two types of shell, or maybe this has been done, that you would put it down and see which one was more efficient in trapping spat set. I asked Roger Mann that. He didn't think it had been done. He did indicate that there's decades worth of data
that we have. Decades worth of data on ones that got house shell versus fossil shell.
But yeah, and I know we looked at some of that at the committee, but I don't think it was that we could do a small project that might discuss the house shell is more efficient. I mean, the price is something, and we get away from that for a minute, but the efficiency with which we get a spat set, I know your opinion, I think, is that there's no difference between the two substrates, but I don't know if there's any data to back that up.
I think we do have data, and no matter, I mean, doing a single bar, I mean, you'd have to do it over broad areas at the same time, because just from one side of the bar that you would put shell. One side you do the other kind of shell. You can see a difference in that just by itself. And so, you know, I mean, just over just years now of looking at these things, they're it's much more year specific than it is culture specific. It doesn't make a difference what culture we're using. If you the right spat set, you get the right you get a spat set, and it's very similar. And it's you know, we can do it, but I don't think you'll know anything more at the end than what we know now, because you're talking about one shell this side, one shell that size. I mean, we've played around on how you would normalize them for the same size, surface area. And that's the difficulty, is that, you know, lots of times you get your best set, like somebody was talking about in that meeting, on the little fines that we don't even like to use. I mean, if you want to talk about number of spat per meter, lots of times we get the highest number on them, but we don't see them last any time. I mean, if you don't get them that first year, they're gone. And it seems like both house shells and dread shells are equal in the fact of how they last over time. The dread shells probably last a little bit longer because they're fossilized, and it doesn't seem like the boring sponges like to eat them as much as they like to eat our regular shell, which is just crazy to think about something eating shell to start with. But the fossilization process seems to slow that down. So, you know, we can run some experiments, but they will be very confusing to sort out, just because the surface area of a house shell is different than the surface area of a dread shell. And, you know, we've done them in tanks, and they seem to be identical. So,
as just a follow-up, I guess, I appreciate that. But if we have existing data that Roger has, he's willing to kind of mine through some of that data, maybe we could address it that way.
No, I mean, we have a lot of data that we know that in Rappahannock, say, we had five bars done with, I mean, all the early Oyster Heritage Program stuff. We had a lot of bars done with nothing but house shells, other ones done with nothing but dread shells. And we can go back and look at that immediately to see if there was any differences. We have a ton of data on, and we got all the information on whichever bar got what type of shell. So it's available, I think, for us to pull out of there.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the commission? You want to proceed with the procurement plan?
Mm-hmm. Procurement plan, just, I mean, it's included in your in your motion, so approve the plan with along with the how we do the business of the purchasing.
I'd make a motion to approve the 2016 Oyster Replenishment Plan and the procurement procedures.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Erskine, second by Mr. Minor. Any discussion on that? Call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any noes? Chair votes aye as well. Motion passes unanimously. Excellent.
So the second part of the Shellfish Management Committee was to begin the process, again, of talking about effort control. If you recall, you know, we had something in place. Just to show you where we are, just as a starting spot, this is our user fee, which is the fee that you have to have in order to use the gears that we've been concerned over. 2015, we're up to the highest amount that we've seen, 991 different user fees. And then when you break it down to the gear that they use, of the 991, 908 are using the hand scrape, which is the most popular gear. The 77 this past year had the dredge, and the Patentong took a really big jump this year from 7 to 44. So, I mean, we continue to see year after year this increase in the number of people using these gears that are relatively efficient, or much more efficient than say, a hand tong. And if you remember last year, staff did a lot of work for the committee, did a lot of work for the commission, breaking down people about on what they did, how many days they worked in the fishery. And just, you know, we had 400 of them that basically that were eligible, didn't buy them. Another 194 in the hand scrapes that they worked less than 20 days, and that's what we used last year, which was 603 people that we took out of the fishery in the regulation, which was about 52% of the numbers, but only accounted for 9% of the harvest. And then it left 541 they were in that in all of our analyses, we're trying to get to the ones that were your full-time watermen, the guys that worked all the time, that 48% was doing 91% of the work. Did the same thing with dredges. 479 of them were less than 20 days and only caught 10% of the harvest, and 206 did, which was only 30% of them, were catching 90% of the harvest that was done with that gear type. So that, you know, is where we left off. That's what we presented to the commission. That's what was rescinded, and we were instructed to start working with the committee on how to do effort control to relook at it. We know that in our regulation in July of 2014, we passed this control date, and it's pretty clear that participation by any individual in the public orchard fishery after the control date will not be considered in the calculation or distribution of orchard fishing rights should entry limitations be established, and that any individual entering the public fishery after the control date will forfeit any right to future participation in the public orchard fishery should further entry limitations be established by the commission. So that was very clear, and actually we did not use that in the first shot at it, because we were trying as a group. The industry was very concerned in our meetings of protecting the full-time waterman, the guy that went out and worked hard, and they said, well, if he goes out and works really hard, even though he came in after the control date, that he should be considered. So we reintroduced the shellfish committee to the control date. Of the 991 that in 2015, 378 of them came after the control date. So 613 before. So that's something that could be considered. In the conversations, the committee is kind of at an impasse. They don't. They certainly voted not to do anything until they see the data from the harvest. And the harvest, that really won't be available till May. But there's a lot of issues on overcapitalization and too many people working to go way beyond the harvest. I mean, the damage that we do to our bars, the damage to the shells, and our investment that we have, as well as people, if they want to be a full-time waterman and get everybody cutting a smaller piece of the pie every year, then those that have stayed with it for year after year after year, their little piece of the pie gets cut smaller by everybody new that comes in. So even if we do status quo on our harvest, which it doesn't look like we probably will, but even if we do, we've had like 160 come in just since the commission decision in September. So it's not slowing down on the number of people that came in. And in the discussions, where we kind of left off was the committee voted to give themselves a little breather and ask the commission, would they pass an emergency regulation to stop the sale of user fees where we are today? Say, until we can look at this thing through the summer, until next August is usually when we'll be shooting to bring this back to you as a commission, that, you know, let's don't give anybody any false impressions that if they buy this user fee, somehow they'll squeak by and they'll be included. Just don't sell anymore now until we pass that, until we see what we're going to do on effort control. And in our heads, you know, we kind of thought, well, that 991 was the number we were, and that's where we'd be, which is a high number. But now that we've had a time to look at this and this regulation, that if you have a copy in front of you, add in that statement, there's actually 1,120 that would pass the test of having a user fee because they bought it either in 2013, 14, and didn't buy it in 15, so they would still be eligible. So our pool is 1,120, which when you start thinking about the total number of watermen of 2,800, it's a very high percentage of all the watermen in the fishery. And if you then start narrowing it down to who actually works, again, it's a very high number percentage amongst all the watermen. So that's the request we have. I mean, I think we would like to have a little bit further guidance from the commission on how they would like the committee to proceed and effort control, whether you're okay with us just sitting and waiting until May when we can see what the harvest is, and then this request for an emergency to to hold the user fees where we are right now.
Other questions from the commission? Mrs. Kellum?
There was a sunset date from SMAC. Is that included?
Not really. I mean, you don't need that. Y'all can take it out, and I mean, it'll just disappear in August. If we decide to not do any effort control, or if we decide to do effort control, that would just come out the next time we open that regulation.
If I can just maybe clarify for the commission, this user fee that we're talking about is for any new licenses that would get into any of the gear types for fish. That's hand scrape, dredge, hand tong. If myself, for example, had a hand tong license, I could then, since I'm in the fishery, go and purchase a hand scrape license.
Okay.
So this doesn't affect people moving from that are in the fishery, the oyster fishery, moving from one gear type to another laterally, but you can't get somebody new coming in to the fishery.
So, I'm sorry.
Mr. Frisk.
Yeah. So right now that puts us at over 1,100 and some odd that could become hand scrapers.
Yes. Yep.
Follow.
Mr. Frisk.
On the ground that we open every year, I know it varies some, but what would you say is a safe estimate of how many people should be working that ground in order to not destroy the bars like some bars I have seen are in terrible shape?
I would say half of certainly, we probably won't get there, but half is probably where you want to be of the 991.
Anybody gulp? Any other questions from the commission? Mr. Francis.
I would like to know what it's cost an oysterman in the past 2 years, the difference of his production and what he would make by the added fisherman, the loss of a day, as we did last fall, and what it would cost a fisherman from 1 year to the next. How much is he losing because of this added fishery?
Well, I mean, he's lost that day, but you have to keep it in mind, like in the Rappahannock, where the areas are pretty much done. They had 2 months season, and they were done in a month. So you've lost the second month's worth of work. I mean, we're lucky we have places to move on to until it finally runs out. But the ideal situation would be that the person would be able to stay there for those full 2 months and be able to catch as much at the beginning as he caught at the end. So, you can certainly figure that out. 8 bushels times 20 days a month. The value of that is loss. It's the whole fishery gets it for certain, but the individual watermen that have stayed with us for a long time, they lose out.
Other discussion, other questions? Mr. Erskine.
Well, I just wanted to offer for the commission, there were some other things discussed at SMAC as well. And one was that open, and this has been heard by us before, but open up more areas, you know, open additional areas, and spread out some of that effort that Mr. France spoke of. So I guess it was twofold. One, and it wasn't a motion, just discussion, but the discussion was to open additional public grounds that have not been opened, as I understood it, as well as staff would look at sanctuary areas and look at the percentage that is in a volume by acres, how many acres are in sanctuaries, and whether or not part of those areas could be open. So those, again, were discussion items, but it was not any motion and really no decision. Consensus, as Jim said, was status quo, to see where the harvest numbers for 2015-16 are in May, and SMAC will meet again in June to discuss this effort reduction further. I'd also remind the commission that we did do effort control last year, and that was one day. Friday was not allowed to be out on the water fishing. So that was effort control. In addition, lastly, any reduction or suggestion that we have for removing licenses from the fishery would not be effective until January 1, 2017.
Correct.
Yeah, we have what we have for this season starting off.
So, as I understand it here, the emergency measure will keep this problem from growing while we examine ways to mitigate the problem, even if we can't fix it. And the problem is not enough oysters for everybody that wants to catch oysters. I mean, that's a simplistic version of it. So, Chief O'Reilly.
So I heard Mr. France's question, and I think with effort control, everything is moving and increasing. It's become very difficult to figure out what has been lost by those who, for whatever reason, are the full-time fishermen, traditional oystermen, however you want to look at it. So with Mr. France, what I envisioned was we used to have 600 and some harvesters is what Jim showed. And you could look to see what has happened as that increased to 991 or whatever it was. You could bin everyone to see exactly how many individuals had 10% less harvest, 20%, 10% more. You could do that. Things like that might help eventually the committee and the commission. The other thing is, I mean, I'm not pessimistic, but I think in this case, the committee at the first meeting, pretty clearly it was a revisitation of where we left off last year. There's going to be some strong personalities that just really believe what was said last year, that the agency is here to make sure they have a harvest. And, you know, so I don't know how to overcome that from a staff level. It's very difficult. It's a different situation because I think limited entry is being confused with effort control. And I think what Mr. Erskine said, probably yes. You know, having those Fridays had some impact, but then we had the influx of the new fishermen. So if we don't really look at it, we can't tell how much. But that is a form of effort control, or at least an attempt. And maybe there are some other forms of effort control that are going to be important before we get to the place where at some point we really have to consider limited entry. But right now, they should be different, I think. I think there should be attempts to control effort. I don't think we're ready for limited entry as far as it goes, because we've already found more people today. We came in today thinking 900 and some. It's 1,120 that have the user fee. And it would be very extremely difficult to tell those individuals that they can't have the user fee now, which is limited entry. I'm not offering many solutions, but I certainly think we can look at some of the information that's been asked today and eventually make some sense of this. But you know, I think it's more important, one thing Jim said, which is really important, so instead of having the harvest for 2 months, you pretty much cleaned it up in a month, and now folks are just going back to the same place and eroding the potential for Spatset. So it's a, I mean, it's tough, and I really wouldn't advocate something like a blue ribbon panel approach, because you get lost in all the makeup of that. But I mean, I think clearly we need, at some point, I think the commission needs to have a group, somewhat industry, somewhat science, that can really look down the road a little bit more. And I doubt we can do that now, because 2017 is right around the corner. But I think eventually that'd be something we would try and do, because it is tough on the advisory committee. I mean, it's tough on them. They're thinking about what their future is as they sit there, and that's pretty tough. And, you know, it's not uncommon. It's just a tough situation. So I hope you don't mind me saying that.
All right, well, then let me ask a basic question. Dr. Wesson, What happens if we do nothing?
If we do nothing, we are just going to have very quick seasons, and we are not going to take advantage of the investment that we have in the shells that we should be taking advantage of, because just as an example, the Temple Bay one, 119 spat per meter before, 16 at the end, after the end of the season. So it's just, you're making people just get a very small piece of the pie, which, you know, then it's obviously, you know, we don't see these people doing wrong and these coming off the beds and stuff until after the season is along, and we've, as long as they got oysters, they stay where they're supposed to be.
That's certainly true.
Yeah.
Mr. Cedron.
Let me ask this question. I mean, last year we tried to knock that number down, and that didn't last too long. But what if we just freeze, like you were saying, just freeze the applications that are on the books right now and just don't let any more new ones? Isn't that what you're asking?
That's 1,120. At least what they had asked for is to freeze it until they can work until August.
Right. And so what got us before the firing squad last time is that we were telling everybody we want to eliminate X number of people who had licenses, and nobody wanted to lose a license. But if we just cut off the license thing now, everybody keeps the license, and we just don't get more. Isn't that right?
Only for it as a temporary measure.
Oh, as a temporary measure, but that's what you're asking for right here.
Right. I mean, that what they're trying to do is that they're afraid that during the conversations, people are going to go in and start buying user fees because they're hearing about us making the conversations. We had four or five come in between our meeting Wednesday that had never had a license and bought them, I think, just because they had heard the discussions just in that short period.
Yep, Mr. Cedron, I have an image of a horse and a barn door, and the problem with freezing this is that the horse has pretty much left the barn. This is just keeping it from getting worse. So I think the question at hand here, and I think the question that staff is asking, is what avenue of pursuit is the commission willing to explore for limiting the number of participants in this fishery, and what vehicle to use for that, if so? We had it up here, but the control date from 2014, if we invoke that and say anybody that's gotten in after 2014 no longer has a license, last one's in, first one's out, it's a pretty good principle. If we have transferability, they will be able to stay within the fishery by buying a license from somebody that has been in but isn't going to stay in or isn't going to use it. I mean, that's one basic thing. That's a basic tenet of limited entry that we use in any number of different fisheries. Does the commission want to go that route? Do you want to go a step further? Do you want to go an entirely different route? Or do you want to basically say, we freeze it, nobody else can get in, and we're going to hope for the best? I mean, that's basically the options that I'm seeing here, unless somebody has better ideas. Mrs. Cohen.
If we went back to the control date, like you're suggesting, we're going to put ourselves in the same position we were in before, and we're going to end up back here rescinding again. I mean, we're doing the same thing that we just went through, basically.
Well, part of the problem last year is that the limited entry system we devised and we passed, and then we rescinded, was not based on the control rule. It wasn't based on the principle being last one in, first one out. What we did with the 20 days spread out over 2 years, so you could have eligibility if you harvested 20 days in 1 year, but not in the other year, but only 20 days average over those 2 years. I tell you, you want to explain that to somebody? Because I tried to, and I'll tell you, it's a hard thing to explain. And as a result, the blowback that I got was that a lot of people felt it was a pretty arbitrary, a pretty capricious way to go about doing what we were trying to do, which was to take their licenses. So if we're going to go limited entry, I would say that it benefits us to go with a way that's as simple as possible and as explainable, that gets us to where we need to go, or at least in the right direction.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my basic thought, but others may have other thoughts on this. Mr. Erskine.
Well, and I think that discussion has taken place at SMAC, and I'd remind the commission that the motion that was passed 9-1 was it's premature to suggest implementing the control date and moving forward with effort control until we see what the harvest numbers are for this season. It's still incomplete, and it won't be available till May or June when we're going to meet again. I would suggest that this emergency regulation is appropriate, and it does freeze or cap or put a moratorium on any new user fees getting into here. We have the 1120, I understand that, and they can move and get other licenses within the fishery. But I think this is a step that we can take and discuss this further. There was a lot of concern on SMAC that we don't want to jump into something without having all the information. And part of that piece of the puzzle is the harvest numbers for 2015 and 16, because we were told there would be a reduction in the fishery, the public harvest, for this season. So I think first we have to see if there was a reduction, and then to what extent did we have that reduction? Was a lot or a little, or negligible, as Jim might suggest? So I think we just need more data. But to implement this emergency measure, I think, is prudent at this point. I would suggest a sunset date, that would be August 31st, which we'd passed it at SMAC.
Chief O'Reilly.
So I hope this is a day of discussion, because we don't want to get ahead too far, but I mean, I can't help thinking that what the commissioner said a moment ago about the 20 days and the average of 2 years, 20 days, I understand that and understood it and why the commission had to come back, but we had zeros. I mean, we had zeros up there. We had people who hadn't done anything, and they were there, and it was quite a few. And with the crab fishery, to remind you what happened in 2008, those who hadn't worked or harvested a single day from 2004 to 2007 were put on a waiting list with the promise that if it happens, I'll be happy, all of you will be happy, that if we can get 215 million spawning age female crabs for 3 years in a row, we have to consider how to put them back in. But there were ways to do effort control right there that we didn't seize upon. They're probably still there. You still have that going on. The other thing is the control date does represent something that was a forethought by the commission.
Right.
When that was done, there was a forethought to do something at that time. I won't disagree about the harvest. It is important to see what that's like. We can get the spat set. That's another component of it. But now we're talking about a whole pool, a big pool of individuals, and whether it makes sense for the future to narrow that at all. So the control date, you know, it's hard to think about this without saying, what do you really have to say is definite? And the control date was done with deliberation by the commission July 1, 2014. The details after that, which Ms. Haney Kellum indicated, the details are you might be right back in that same awful situation that everyone was in to renege, get rid of the effort control system from last year. Well, some kind of transfer system. That's the way the blue crab fishery works. There are up to 100 transfers a year, and if you're a family member, you don't count as part of that 100. And generally, we have 70 or 80 transfers in crabs. There are ways to work around it, but I'm not being pessimistic because I do think the control date gives us a starting point. I don't know whether the SMAC will, you know, move on that or not. I don't know, but it is something that is, it doesn't seem arbitrary, which is what the commissioner worried about with the 20 days. So,
and the control rule isn't like, and you read it right there, it's not like it doesn't give very clear, very fair warning. You get into this fishery after this date, you should have no expectation of remaining in that fishery. I mean, that's kind of clear. We could go that route. We may feel that we can go that route and should maybe take another step forward for looking at other options to augment that.
Right.
Rob brought up the waiting list in the blue crab fishery. I mean, you might want to think about moving forward on identifying those who have no harvest for a set number of years. And if you want to remove those licenses, you can. You haven't used them, you know, why should you have them if you're not going to use them? You can use as a principle. Or you could say, well, we're going to set them aside here on a waiting list here for the day when we end up with a million bushels of annual harvest off the public oyster ground. And I pray that day arrives in my lifetime. So I guess what staff is asking for, do you all have some ideas on a basic direction that you would like to go to explore a possible limited entry fishery? Mr. France, I saw your hand.
Yeah, one of my main concerns is this. It's for the full-time watermen. I mean, a lot of watermen are very diverse, and they do a lot of different things. And some watermen may have a hand scrape license and may not have used it for a couple of years because they're off in another fishery that's doing well at the time. But that fishery, as a lot of fisheries we see in the bay, may fall off for a few years, and they may have to revert back to their hand scrape. And as a full-time waterman, you need as many irons in the pot as you can be. Can have, or you know, if you miss one fishery because another one goes down, then you're going to be out of business.
Mr. Packer,
I certainly agree with what Mr. Francis saying. However, I think this control date is our best way forward. I mean, it's we gave notice some time ago. Everybody knew it was there, and it was, as you said, Rob. It was, we thought about it. It makes sense, and this has to be a limited entry fishery, in one way or another. It has to be a limited entry fishery, and if we're going to manage it, I think we need to use the control date. That's my opinion.
Mrs. Kell. Mr. Zeber.
I like both their ideas, and why can't we pass it with this control date, and then if let's say Mr. France here, he decided to go striper fishing for 2 years. But before that, he did a lot of oysters. So, and then the stripers went away. And if he could demonstrate that he was an oyster guy, that could be an exception to the fact that he didn't fish the oysters for 3 years. And therefore, it wouldn't cut his income off. I mean, I can see both of these coming together here and working with staff that would be fair to the watermen, you know.
Mr.
Packer.
The other part, though, is that if the industry is viable, these licenses can be transferred. You know, you make the investment, just like the state of Virginia has made an investment in the oyster fishery. You know, these individuals can make an investment in buying a license. But if we let everybody in, the investment's not going to be worth anything on our part. It's not going to be worth anything on the fishermen's part.
Any other? Mr. Erskine.
Well, I guess, and I appreciate all the comments, and I certainly think they're all valid, because we demonstrated by taking action last year that we identify a problem or a potential problem. We think that there's a lot of effort in this fishery. But I guess I need clarification. Are we talking about doing something here today about the control date?
No.
Okay, thank you. So I guess my other follow-up is I appreciate the zeros because I still felt strongly that we should have kept those zeros where they were. The 20 days agreed was kind of arbitrary, but the zeros were there. That's not dealing with effort because they're zeros, so they didn't harvest anything. That's latent effort that, you know, you're not doing effort control. But you're eliminating them from potentially getting involved in the future, and that's very, I think that is very important. So maybe we could suggest to staff that we look at those zeros again, and we allow SMAC to do its work in June and look at the harvest for 2015 and 16, and we be prepared as a commission to, you know, take action down the road if that's what we feel is necessary. But I really do think it's prudent to find out what the total harvest is and the spat set that took place this year. So.
Ms. Hurston, that's very heartening. And I think I agree pretty much almost completely with what you're saying here, with a bit of a caveat. Now, I guess what I would most like out of this is a fishery that is manageable, that the watermen who are participating have harvest opportunities and can make a living and are not losing their economic benefits to newcomers or to part-timers or to those people here that are not committed to the oyster fishery. I like the idea of getting rid of some of the latent effort as well. If they haven't harvested anything, keeping the licenses on the books is just a license to run into a problem down the road. We have that problem with the crab fishery. We've had it for years. Nobody has found a way, a solution to that. A kind of step off of that is having a waiting list for those people in the crab fishery that could get back in or their license reactivated when the harvest levels reach a certain point. And I could see a mixture of all three of these components as a viable path forward here, where we would have the newcomers would have to transfer a license to stay in, and we would have a certain number of full-time oystermen. We would remove those people that haven't used them for X number of years, and if we need to get a little bit further to make sure that this is a full, stable life economic opportunity for the full-time oystermen here, maybe the real part-timers get set to a side. You're next in when the stocks grow. So I don't know. I'm throwing that out there. Do you guys think that is a viable way to go forward here to instruct staff to work along these lines?
Yes.
Or if somebody has another idea for a different path to go. We don't have to do all of this, but those are options that get us to where I think we probably will want to end up being. I see heads nodding here, but I don't hear enthusiasm.
I don't think we have any other choice, to be honest with you. I'm sorry.
AJ?
Well, and I agree. I think getting all the information is prudent. I mean, we should do that. I would say, based on what I heard from SMAC last week, there would be several on that committee that would disagree with that.
So, and what would be their basis for disagreement?
The first reason would be it's a public fishery, and we should not limit who gets into a public fishery. Second, that instead of looking at controlling the fishermen, that you would look at opening additional ground. So there's ground out there, whether it's in a sanctuary or whether it's in areas that are public ground that have not been opened in a number of years, that those areas would be open.
But that's part of our strategy has been this rotation of grounds that has been successful.
Open up more rotational area, yes.
And part of the strategy has been the sanctuary serving as broodstock for these river systems. Right. We get rid of the broodstock.
But if I can give you a little history, in like 1988, 89, we had the first blue ribbon oyster panel. And that's when things were really bad. We didn't have any strategy at all. And what came out of those recommendations were, and the big battle that we fought in 1993 and 94, he basically closed everything at that point. That was the recommendation, and opened it up as we did work to improve the bottom. The only thing that was open at that time, when we closed that thing, was the James River Hand Tong area and Seaside. We went all the way back to that low level. And we struggled with, you know, coming up with strategies that would bring washer beds back from like the mid-90s until 2000, and then we kind of struck by happenstance on, you know, maybe some forethought into these rotations, and we got a lot of money. I mean, oysters were hot. We got a lot of money for shells. And it was still the commission's opinion at that time that we would build and open. We'd build and open, but you wouldn't send people out on bottom that is just mud and not been touched to just go hunt on it, because the problem with that, and that will still be the problem with opening new ground that we've not done any work on, is that we can't keep the people on the areas that we are tightly controlling them on to keep off private ground and everything. But you can imagine letting them go anywhere on any public ground that has no oysters. They'll not end up on their ground. They'll end up on somebody's private ground. And plus, these areas that have been left alone have had, maybe they've had a few oysters come back, but the oysters have come back on their own. It wasn't through any help that we did by providing a substrate. So it may start out with a crab pod, and then the oysters build, attach to that and build around that. So they're little places, and there are just the trivial amount of product on these areas that we've not gone in and put shells on is just so small. The loss of that spawning stock would so outweigh that it, you get a one-year little teeny boost, a few thousand bushels, but we don't know what those few thousand bushels are doing for us. Because if I actually looked at, you can do the exercise yourself. If you go on our Chesapeake Bay map, we have the public ground, we have the areas that are open, and you can look and you can see how few acres are out there. Unless you start talking about going out in the middle of the bay, or you talk about, let's say, the Pocosin River, or somewhere we've never done any work in, or something like that, it's just very, very little bottom. I think when we do the exercise with the watermen, they'll see that. But there is not a mother load of oysters out there somewhere that we don't know where they are, because we have monitored all these areas, and we know it's mostly just mud and has not been any kind of effort put in to bring it back. If we had unlimited money, we could expand significantly the areas that we work. But we've always been limited to the funds that we have.
Let me make one more point that's kind of along those lines here. A man who can't make a living on the water here is going to be tempted to cut in corners. And we've seen some violators in the past here are willful and they're egregious. And there are some that I've suspected have done so because of a sense of desperation, that they're not making what they need to make in order to pay their basic living costs and to support their family. The oyster aquaculture industry and privately leased ground is contributing their own money into propagating oysters. The theft of oysters will inhibit that. I don't want to see that industry, that sector of the fishery, contract because we can't stop people from stealing. And if we don't have a fishery that's limited to the people, to enough people who can make a living at it with the amount of stocks that we have, we are asking and almost enticing people out of a sense of desperation to go looking for oysters where they should and ought to. So I feel strongly about this here because, frankly, the Marine Police have enough to do, and we're finally getting our arms around this thievery issue here. If we can't keep this fishery in a manageable quantity of participants that can make a living doing this, this oyster thievery, this oyster poaching problem is not going to get any better. It's going to get worse, is my fear. Mr. Tankard.
Well, I'm back to the notion of a public fishery. I think we maybe need to decide what is a public fishery. Is it just have at it? I don't think that is a public fishery. I think a public fishery is something that we can maintain or attempt to maintain on a year, a decade-by-decade basis. But if we decide public fisheries just have at it, as you see fit, I don't think that's the real definition. I think it's sustainability is the definition of a public fishery.
Mr. Erskine.
So I just want to be clear, I'm not advocating for a wide-open fishery. It's my responsibility as chair of SMAC, in my opinion, to bring these alternatives and discussion that took place at the meeting to the commission. So I'm not advocating for one or the other.
I wasn't maintaining that you were. I just think, though, that maybe that's one of the things we need to sort of put out in print. What is a public fishery in Virginia?
I'd just like to comment on the commissioner, if I can, the comment about poaching. I agree, it's been a unbelievably difficult issue, you know, for the industry, public and private fishery. But it makes me wonder, because we've had the largest last year was the largest harvest we've had in the public and private fishery in the last 25 years. So it's counterintuitive to think that people are out there looking for oysters when we've had the largest harvest. I think there are rogue individuals in the fishery, and we've seen them come before us. And this commission's done an excellent job at removing those individuals from the fishery. And people that are going to do the wrong thing, they're going to do the wrong thing. And I think the commission should be proud of the fact that, you know, we have a viable industry and everybody is moving in the same – I think we're all pulling in the same direction. We want to sustain that harvest. However we get there, there might be some discussion along the way. But I agree with the effort control. We need to get that, you know, on the table and discuss these kind of things. I just don't want to jump into a lot of these issues without it going through SMAC, because that's a process we have, and bringing all the items to the commission for discussion.
Mr. France had to stand up first.
I'm sorry. But, you know, you talk about a public fishery, and this was brought up at Shellfish Advisory, and, you know, striped bass is a public fishery, I consider, and crabbing is a public fishery also, and we have limits on those and how many people can be in them. And somebody said at the committee meeting, I think, you know, it'll take care of itself. Leave everybody in it. But if you do, and the and oysters drop off, you know, regular people or part-timers can go back to their jobs. It's going to be the regular waterman that suffers. It's going to be the first one that's out of the industry.
Mr. Packer.
Yeah, well, I think AJ's comment, the poachers we've seen, I think it's been a little bit, as you've seen in papers around the Chesapeake Bay region, the gold rush term has been used over and over again, and I think that's kind of what we've seen. The success of our efforts has led to a bit of a gold rush where people decide, hey, I'm going to get in this thing. I kind of never did it before, but I'm going to get in, and we've seen people think, oh, I don't even know anything about any of these regulations, so therefore you shouldn't punish me. You know, I just, you know, we've seen this. But, you know, I had one other thought about on the public fishery is that it is just that. It's not just the folks who are in it fishing. It's the total public. It's the Commonwealth's fishery. And I want to get back to what was my other thing. SMAC, in my mind, they kind of dropped the ball on us in a way. I mean, they threw it out. Don't do anything. I would hope that we'll let SMAC know, hey, we want to see something pop out.
Sir? I think where we're all going towards is that this public oyster fishery is a privilege, not a right. And we need to make that clear, that it's just not by right you can go and take your harvest on public ground. That's not the way it is. But I don't think SMAC necessarily dropped the ball. I think they just wanted to gather more information and data right now for the spring, because we don't have to make a decision until the end of August. So they're just looking at more information. To give them direction, I agree. You know, maybe the commission can give them a few ideas to look at. And I would believe, even though, you know, it gets difficult at times, we'd all be willing to discuss those at SMAC. Yep. And I think that's the process we should look at.
Okay. Does staff have some guidance?
Yes.
Does staff need further clarification on the guidance?
I think so. I think all of us worked with the data. Adam's done a lot of the data workup, so we know what to do with the zeros. I'm intrigued by Mr. France's question to maybe trace what has happened over the last 2 years, that the, you know, the oyster people who have done a certain amount, what are they doing now? They've been impacted by what's going on. We're sort of holding even, Mr. Erskine said, or even improving a little bit despite what's going on. But yet, we all know that it can't last forever. because you don't get a dispatch set. You know, we had it 2012, we had it 2015, then it was 2011, then it was 2013, then it was 2014. It's not something you can go to the bank on. But the one thing out of today that I can just mention, one thing it is that I thought
last time around, last year, sorry, Kathy, that the commission had staff information and the commission had SMAC information, which was pretty much stay status quo. And the commission, at least this is the way I saw it before, last September or whatever it was, the commission did not have an open discussion about everything involved. And so today I'm really elated that there has been this discussion, and I think that'll help all of us, staff, commission members, everyone else. So I really appreciate this happening today.
I do as well. I think this is a very worthwhile discussion. And hopefully it charts us a bit of a path forward here, or at least potential paths forward here, and let's work, have staff work on these issues here and have SMAC vet them, and of course we want to see what the harvest is going to be, was. Which leaves us to adoption of this emergency management, this emergency measure, and some members of the commission's desire to include a sunset provision in this. Do you want to discuss that a bit further? Or are we good with this regulation as written as an emergency regulation here that caps the user fees?
I think the emergency part of it does kind of, in a way, sunset it. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
We'll have a public hearing next month to make it permanent.
The question would be whether to include a sunset provision in the final reg.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's not a matter we need to worry about today. We can worry about that next month.
Yes, sir.
All right. So do I hear a motion here to adopt this emergency regulation?
So moved.
Second. Motion by Mr. Tankard, second by Mr. Neal. Any discussion on this that we haven't already had?
After we move on, I've got a request.
I'll call a question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any noes? Chair votes aye as well. The motion passes unanimously. Other business. Mrs. Cohen.
I don't have blue paper, but I have an emergency measure request. And I was hoping they'd be here to speak for themselves, but they're not. The Patton Tongers from Deep Rock. It's a small group of 12 boats or less, some with one man, some with two men, and they're all full-time watermen, have requested a 5 to 10 day extension on the end of their season. Today's probably the last day due to the weather forecast that they're going to be able to work. Since they were trying to take advantage of the last day today, they're not here to present it themselves.
We have Patton Tongers and we have the old Patton Tongers that are the seven here that have stayed at Deep Rock year in and year out, have worked every day so far this year except for one. New Patton Tongers have missed days, and they're asking for more days. But you can see the really big jump. We only have one Patton Tong area. We can go from 7 licenses to 44. And that is a really big jump for us not having seen that much before. So I don't think there's any way that you could suggest adding time to that when the guys that are full-time at this have been out there and have made the whole 90-day season. So,
Mrs. Haney.
And the guys that are requesting it are the 12 full-time.
No, but they're not the ones that have been out there every day. The guys that have been it in the long term have asked me, don't even think about, they called me last night all concerned that this would come before, don't even think about extending this, that they've seen the biggest decline that they've seen out there, and they've been watching this grow for the past 6 or 7 years that we've had this area.
Well, I know the ones that had called me directly were...
They're the new ones.
Well, they've been all season.
But they had not been there before this year.
That I couldn't answer. I just wanted to bring it. And like I say, they weren't here to represent themselves, so.
If you want, you can make that in the form of a motion. Or you can let it die, or what's your preference?
Well, since I've gone this far, I'd make a motion to extend the season 5 days to give them what they're going to lose for the remainder of the season due to the weather forecast.
Everybody understand the motion? Motion by Mrs. Cohen?
Second
by Mr. Miner. Is there a discussion on this? Mr. France? Mr. Erskine?
Well, I just, I guess, in light of what staff said, I mean, I understand, I'm less familiar with it, I guess. I know we looked at SMAC about the 7 licenses going to 44 this past year, but they're not here. I guess I wonder, well, it's unfortunate, certainly, because they would be the ones to be able to speak to it, I guess. But, you know, I think we just had a lengthy discussion about effort in the fishery, and I just, you know, I'm not sure I could vote in favor of something like that at this point.
Mrs. Kelly?
And just to make it clear, they're not here because they were trying to get today in, being the last day.
I understand.
I have a problem trying to micromanage these things due to weather. We live in a world, this is weather every year. And so, you know, that's part of our seasons is, you know, we're going to have a certain number of days that the weather's bad and whatnot. And so I have a real problem saying, oh, let's give you 5 more days because it's going to be windy tomorrow.
And actually, this area gets a 3-month season because it's exposed and we know we have weather out there. I mean, where most of the area's got a 2-month season. So.
And
this is Cole.
I understand, Mr. Neal. It is, they don't receive a paycheck week to week. It is a paycheck for these watermen. If they're not out there, they're not going to receive it. So.
And I guess that's true of all watermen. I mean, we've got this with all every one of these. We still have seasons. I mean, it's still a close. I guess I have a problem is micromanaging this when that can be said true of everybody out there.
Mr. Seaver.
I don't think this is limited to watermen. I do farming as well. And, you know, if it's so wet out there in the ground right now, I don't know if I'll be able to plant anything until July. And, of course, it'll burn up by then. So I don't think this is unique to the watermen. I think anybody that works in nature, as Mr. Neal said, has got to count on the fact that, you know, whatever it happens, and you got to deal with it. And so, you know, and I was one of the guys last time when they had to freeze up in the Tangier Island, you know, we extended there the thing, but I don't think just general weather is reaches to that level that we need to do something as we did for the Tangier people. So I agree with him.
I'll just point out, you know, 7 to 44, that's a 630% increase in participants, you know, and you've got this, the 7 saying, hey, man, maybe we shouldn't let these guys keep going because it's going to hurt their paycheck long term. The 7 have been in it for so long. Hurt them in 2016, et cetera. So I kind of think they ought to live with what they have. I certainly sympathize with what you're saying.
Any other discussion? It's motion by Mrs. Kellum, second by Mr. Miner. I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Can I see a show of hands, please? Mr. France, Mrs. Kellum, Mr. Miner. All those against? Mr. Tankard, Mr. Zedron, Mr. Neal. Mr. Erskine, and the chair votes no as well. The motion fails. Sorry. Thank you. It was fair hearing. Any other matters to be brought before the commission? I'll let the record note. We're done before 5 o'clock. Meeting's adjourned.
Just that in. Thank you.